The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill limits functionality yet again. John uses cutouts to conceal what's in a huge mining barge. Tom commutes cross-country for millions of miles. More frauds, spies, and lies. Another pitch goes wild. And Maria meets Ada. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Avi, it's great to hear you. How are you doing these days?
Very good, thank you.
So I understand that you have the newest, greatest sleep apnea thing in the world. Can you just tell us briefly what it is?
It's a device for people who suffer from moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea and do not tolerate the CPAP. But at least half of the patients who receive CPAP do not tolerate it, and thus they have no solution.
So let's talk about the CPAP. So the CPAP is basically a positive airflow. It just shoves air into your mouth. You put it over your mouth and nose, and you're supposed to fall asleep with this thing shoving air into you. And so that's probably why a lot of people can't tolerate it, right?
Yeah. 40 million people who were diagnosed to be moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea patients and do not tolerate the CPAP.
Okay. So 40 million, when you said 40 million people who, wait a minute, customers, right? 40 million potential customers.
Exactly.
Okay. So lots of potential customers. Just to get a sense of this, you know, the CPAP has that toleration problem. Well, what do you do that's easier than the CPAP on the patient?
We have no pump. We have no tube from a machine to a mask on your nose or nose and mouth. We just have a dental plate, which a person put on his upper teeth before going to sleep. And there's a cable from the dental plate to a small box on the chest.
Do I have to have the box on my chest or can the box go somewhere else?
The box can be either on your chest or your arm or your head, wherever you prefer.
It has to be on your body or can it be over
on
the side?
No. It has to be on the body because there's a cable connecting the box to the dental plate.
But suppose we, instead of having the box connected by a cable, suppose we did it wirelessly. Can we just do
No. There is a stent which is inside this cable. It's like a drone cable or bicycle cable. That the stent is inside the cable. And the stent has to go into your upper airway while you are asleep.
Okay, wait a minute. So what you're saying here is there's not a tube, whatever it is, there's something that you're going to push down my throat while I'm asleep, right?
Right, and you don't feel it.
I don't feel it. Well, that's good, because if I felt it, I'd be very unhappy. So let's just talk about, so if I turn over the wrong way or twist my head or something, nothing bad's going to happen, right?
Nothing can happen. You can slip on the side, on your back, even on your on your belly if you can. Most men cannot sleep on their belly.
Well, but all right, so however you sleep, what it's going to do here is it's going to sneak down your throat at night while you're asleep. Okay, now this sounds like a horror science fiction movie. Right?
So yes.
How do you get people over that initial thought process of saying, I'm going to be asleep and something's going to sneak down my throat? Is that a psychological problem or do people not even mind it or no?
The people who went through our clinical study for the proof of concept, they understood it before and nobody objected. My fear before the clinical study was that people will not tolerate well the stent, or they might have gag reflex. And nothing happened. Nobody complained about the stent. Nobody had gag reflex.
I get a gag reflex from looking at something like that.
Yeah, me too. The whole idea, and this is patented, is that the stent has to go in very, very slowly. Think that it has to go in between 2 and 3 inches into your upper airway over a period of about 15 minutes. The nerves get used to it, and you don't feel it.
So if I have a nightmare and I wake up suddenly, is it going to pull the stent back out?
Nothing. You can take it off if you want. You can press a button that will pull the stent back into the cable. And you can go, for example, to the bathroom. With it in, you don't feel it.
Oh, okay.
And you can even drink while it's in, but you cannot eat.
Okay, so I can go to the bathroom. We're going to have something to drink. But if I'm actually going to have breakfast, I probably need to take it out, right? Okay. All right, another question for you. Is this much more expensive or less expensive than the CPAP?
No, it's going to be around the same price of middle-class CPAP.
Does it require cleaning, right? Because CPAPs, one of the problems is they get all moldy and they get stuff in them. So when you're breathing, it's actually probably putting disease into you at night. Do you have any problems related to that, or is that not a problem with your stuff?
No. Before waking up, when the sensors in the dental plate sense that it starts awakening, it pulls back the stent into the cable. Person gets up, he takes it off, he puts it in a unit next to the bed. The unit next to the bed does a few things. First thing, it opens the stent, check that the stent is okay for the next use. It cleans the stent and the dental plate, pull back the stent into the cable, charges the battery, and downloads all the information which was gathered during the night, during the sleep, and send all the information via the cloud to the patient's MD and also to us. The information includes information like on apneas, on snoring, on heartbeat, on oxygen saturation, heart condition.
All right, so hang on. Do you get all that information from the stent, or is that from the box, or how do you get that?
It's all information from different sensors, which are in the dental plate and some also in the box.
Okay, so this is a complex sensor system. It's a pretty complex cybernetic system. It figures out when to move the stent in, when to pull it out. It does analysis on whether you're waking up or falling asleep and the whole set of things. So that's a pretty complicated system. How many computers are involved? Is it just one chip you have in there, or do you have
one chip?
One chip.
One chip. Yeah.
Custom chip, or you want to use an FPGA or something like that?
It's a custom chip for us.
That's a bit pricey to make, but okay.
Custom no, chip. It's not. You know, it's pricey if you want to do 10 or 100 pieces, but if you do 100,000, that's cheap.
Okay, so the price drops because of volume. Perfect.
Right.
Well, Avi, when will this be on the market?
In about 2 years after we collect money now.
You're raising funds. That's right. So they can go to thecybershow.co and they can click on the link for your GWiz and they can find out about the company and get in touch with you. Just so they know, this is not your first rodeo, right?
No, I've already done 7 exits in the past 20 years. I also closed 4 companies during that time. And I can tell you that in a startup which I initiated in 1999, we started the company in 2000. We did IPO in Nasdaq in August of 2004. And first, one of the first investors who invested $350,000 sold his shares in 2007 or 2008 for $70 million.
Whoa.
200 times. $350,000 made $70 million. 70. 200 times. Second investor invested $1.5 million, sold her shares, I think in 2008, for $75 million. 50 times.
Yeah, all I need is that initial money and to go back in time, and I would be wealthy.
Yes.
There's a drive into deep left field. Look out now. That ball is going. Going out. World's going to deliver.
more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. According to news reports, a recent Navy war game indicated that automated weapon systems could decide to kill the people who launched the weapons by following Asimov's three laws of robotics. However, the naval officer revealing this then denied that any actual war game was undertaken. And that's breaking news yet again on the Cyber Show. Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
Back in the days of the Orange Book, DOD was very, very concerned about user-to-user isolation within the system. On the outside, they were very, very poor at assigning user IDs and passwords and managing user IDs and passwords, so that all the work that they went to be able to separate users internally, they gave up by not being able to identify them properly on the outside.
Right. Well, so there's big issues, right? You're scaling to many more, not just individual human beings, but all the devices and everything else that gets interconnected, right? So it's all one big mashup of everything. The other side of all this is the world is, I think, way better off today for information technology and the progress it's making than it was, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, and so forth, right? All the benefits of rapid progress that are gained by the Wild West version of things are really fantastic. But I do think it's getting to where we need to get to the end of the Wild West, you know, get more into the, and I hate to say the corporatized version of it, because I'm not a big fan of the corporatized version of it either.
Well, I am hoping that, well, and in fact, you see it today, there are far more mobile computers, single user computers, purpose-built computers in the network than there are the general purpose flexible. And of course, I'm trying to discourage the general purpose flexible complex in any case. You know, I want people to use simple devices. I want them to use iOS in preference to Android, just because iOS is more closed. Now, that's not to say that you and I can't operate our Android devices safely, but we do not recommend Android to children and old people.
So first of all, age discrimination, I'm against it, right? So I hate to tell you this, Bill, but you're an old person. And
I am,
so
yeah.
Am I. But I still write programs, and I believe that I need the functions that I have in the computers that I have. And if you try and restrict me to what works on an iPad, I can't do my job. And I've tried it. On the other hand, when I go on the road, you know, I take my Chromebook with me, and I don't take the computer that I use to do all my development with me. That stays in a physically separated, secured area. And, you know, it's in some sense separated from the world by a variety of controls that I have in place for it. They have to be simple to implement, not slow me down in my work, and so on and so forth, right? So efficiency and effectiveness must be had together if we're going to be successful in the world. Anytime you try to make security sufficiently an impediment to getting your job done, security is going to fall by the wayside, because we will bypass it to get our jobs done.
Absolutely. But I remember thinking at the time that you made your presentation in Hawthorne that part of our problem is the fact that we mix programmability with all the other functions that we, all the other applications that we want to use. And I thought, gee, yes. You know, if we got rid of programmability, a lot of our security problems would go away.
So when you say get rid of programmability, it's that the programmability should not be there when you don't want it. You want to be able to write programs, but I want to be able to say, look, this thing is locked down. So, you can't program that anymore. I'm going to use that. But there's some other things. There's a lack of backward compatibility, which means you have to keep updating things constantly. And these days you're updating with third-party everything through a supply chain that we have no idea of how to trace it. And even though things like SBOM attempt to do that, the reality is there are so many things in any computer you have that you're probably depending on a million people.
Absolutely. And the bigger the population, the lower the level of trust. We didn't have a problem with Unix systems until the population of users exceeded 50. And at that point, the trust and the interdependence broke down.
You didn't have the utility of Unix systems that you have today, because scale is how you get utility. The main utility is sharing, right? If you can't share it, if I can't make it available to somebody else, then yeah, the computer's great for whatever I want to do personally if I can program it. But without that sharing, the functionality just isn't going to be there. We don't get those effects of the network.
Isn't software reuse wonderful?
Software errors are reusable.
Software reuse is wonderful. DNA reuse is wonderful, right? You know, this is, you know, information sharing literally goes back to the dawn of life, right? You know, the reason we're here is because information was successfully shared probably between lipid bubbles, right? You know, that formed into cells and so forth and managed to take. I mean, we're walking around with all sorts of old code inside us. It isn't necessarily being used for the intended purpose, and it makes us vulnerable to things in our environment. So welcome, cyber, to the biological reality that we live in a fully connected world.
I think it might be hard to accept
right?
this brave new world. The idea that, especially for engineers and control freaks, the idea that it's going to do something that we don't want it to do and didn't predict it does or should do. It seems great when you talk about things like what ChatGPT does and what you know, generative AI in general does and Bard and so forth. But when it comes to, you know, your car and the brakes working, I would just not think it's sensible to depend on that. I think there are plenty of high surety applications where you really want to have that carefully engineered situation. And I think if you look at the progress of safety in airlines, I think that's what you find. It's just tighter and tighter controls over engineering and process and every step of it, trying to wipe out the human failures that go along with it. And I think that's why it's been successful at achieving that goal. It's narrow-minded, but it works.
I think the qualifier is fewer than you would think, right? You know, as engineers and control freaks, you know, we want to say, okay, we can do this for everything. But, you know, air travel is its own thing, which has a survivability rate that's ridiculous, you know, safer than walking, right, you know, and everything else. But, you know, for all sorts of reasons, we've decided to engineer it that far.
And we should be doing the same thing for trains and for cars, because we can. There's no reason to not have a car be as safe as we reasonably can have it be, recognizing that we're not going to be having limited drivers on the cars, although maybe with automated driving, we will be able to eliminate the, you know, humans driving into other humans intentionally part.
But you can't eliminate risk in, you know, entirely. And this is the fundamental paradigm of engineering versus reality, right? And I've been doing all these podcasts on transparency for supply chain security purposes, but I honestly think it's the same thing. I think it's like freedom of speech and democracy, right? It's easy to say, but, you know, right? In business, you know, I've been asked so often, it's like, you're naive, kid. You know, you don't understand. This is how it works. You got to know the right people. It's like, well, I think if you build trust, and in my later career, it turns out that's true. Well, the real business value isn't in the backroom deal. It's in having mature network of contacts, you know, that know each other well enough that you can act quickly and effectively and get things done. So it's, I think the open systems argument in security is the same sort of thing. It's easy to say, but not a lot of people really believe it. You know, yes, but I don't know. I think if you just lean into the fact that you're not going to eliminate all the risk, you know, that we're going to cycle through forever. We're going to pick things like, as we say, air travel. Sure, we'll make that ridiculously safe. Why? Because we want to when we can. But not everything, that's too slow.
I agree that not everything has to be that way, but lots of things can be that way. Right. And the other thing is, if you build some of the underlying infrastructure mechanisms, the chips, the operating environment, so they are that way, and you take that care because of the enormous volume, because of the enormous consequence of a failure in these things, then that's where it's worth doing it. You know, obviously for my little programs that run, you know, my little set of customer base or whatever, who cares? I don't even care. I'm not willing to go to that extreme. And I'm about as extreme as you can reasonably get in terms of being willing to go as far as it takes to be certain,
right,
to a defined level. But it's still, that's not happening today. I mean, it's not happening at almost any level. It might be happening in nuclear weapons.
I honestly think it's one of these things that I don't expect to see even in my most optimistic extended lifetime. Maybe 50, 60 years from now, you know, say I make it 120. Yeah, I think of John Alsop, my boss in the early firewall days. like 1995, and I got really excited and say, you know, television will be gone in 5 years. And he explained to me the realities of manufacturing. You know, these things take a long time to change. And the advantage of these open systems and everything from chip design and so on and so forth are just so huge. As you and I know, we agree. You know, we debate these things a little bit, but it's a matter of degrees. I think we will, in the end, have all sorts of, you know, devices, smart things that are only do one thing. But that's spoke nano manufacturing on a large scale. That's,
but you don't have to do, no, we already have that effective capability with field programmable gate arrays, right?
Yeah,
so you devise the mechanism so that it's rock solid. And then the customization is something you can burn into it, and you can do it very inexpensively today. I mean, not for a penny per wall device. You know, you can do that, including the capability to have it rock solid in terms of not being able to be modified, not being able to be used as a Trojan horse, not being able to use to do denial of services, not being able to, you know, use to guess passwords or do intelligence on your infrastructure and so forth. There's just no reason that those things need to be that general purpose. And in fact, if you just go with an Arduino today instead of a Raspberry Pi, I know we're talking specific technologies, but an Arduino, it's pretty straightforward to design that thing. It doesn't have, as far as I can tell, a built-in mechanism for a command line. It's just whatever you program it to do. Those are things you can do readily and today and inexpensively and in volume.
Yep. I expect to work in that world the rest of my life. We actually on scale start making, you know, dedicated devices. Yeah, you know, the FPGAs and, you know, the existing technologies. I kind of expect it all to change before we get there. I could be wrong.
The other side of that is you have to get the people who are building these things to adopt that. And that's where the big problem comes in. As you're well aware, I have, you know, several companies I work with that produce, we'll call it IoT devices for medical or for whatever use. And I continue to talk to them about doing the security aspects, and they're, nope, that can come someday.
Right.
It's always going to come later, right? It's going to come later than making more sales.
Yep.
Until it becomes so painful, until an incident happens that's so painful, it forces them down that road. And there's only two outcomes that can come. One of them is they go out of business, and the other one is they're making so much money they can afford it, which comes to another discussion. What happens in an evolutionary world when I have 10 companies? And the 10 companies are competing in the same environment, and three of them have rock solid security, and the other seven have crap. And the other seven are spending all that money that the three are spending on rock solid security on sales and marketing. So the ones that are spending it on sales and marketing get more of the market. So now a year later, one of the three high surety ones has failed, and three of the other seven low surety have failed. So there are four low sureties and two high sureties left. And a year after that, there's only two of the low sureties, and maybe both of the high sureties are left, but the two low sureties have, you know, 95% of the market. So they buy the high surety companies and say, great, we've bought you out of the market and we don't really care, so it doesn't matter anyway. So going forward,
that's what I mean about the economics.
Yeah, the money you spend on sales and marketing is a better return on investment over the short term than the money you spend on security.
Right. You know, 30 years ago in critical infrastructure, I saw this, you know, huge risk. And like a lot of our peers, you know, it's like, oh my God, we need to fix this now. But honestly, you know, 20 years later, if you had spent the money I expected you to spend 20 years before that, you would have basically replaced all that anyways. And the infrastructure wasn't attacked. So if your peers, your competitors had not done those things, then they would have that incremental advantage because they had more time, attention, money, resource. It's just true. Right. So the economics, not just when I can add a dollar to my product, but my competitors do as well.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields.
Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
Okay, so now you get off the desert, and now you have to put this on the water. So what were the OPSEC issues and operation security issues in getting something on the water when people couldn't know what it was or what it looked like?
Well, there's a major piece between the desert and the water, okay? And that major piece was the manufacturing of the actual demonstrator. And what we did was resurrect an old CIA program artifact called the Hughes Mining Barge. The Hughes Mining Barge was part of the Glomar Explorer program when we recovered that Soviet submarine. Okay, it is actually a submarine. It will go down and it will come back up. The top opens. The claws would go down and pick stuff up and what have you. So we decided to build the demonstrator inside the Hughes mining barge.
Inside it.
Inside the Hughes mining barge, which was a, so then we had to decide where we were going to park the Hughes mining barge because it floated. It didn't roll.
It was too big.
So we ended up picking a site in Redwood City, California, close to our facility here. So I had to lay out a cover and deception plan that introduced the barge through the area. And we did things like held a for the mayor and the people who, the fire department, the emergency services people, we actually brought a brigadier general out to that meeting and said, fellas, we want you to take a look at the Hughes mining barge. And we had brochures that were made up back when the Hughes mining barge
was. Like a museum piece, right?
Yeah. And so we said, now, we are going to build something in this barge that none of you will ever see. And so, but we want to show you that we're not growing marijuana and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And this is a legitimate national defense program. So there were a few guys, well, you know, gee, I have to inspect all this stuff. Sir, you won't be inspecting this. And there will be substantial security around this facility.
If you try to inspect it, somebody will kill you.
Yeah. Well, that might have happened because they were armed. We actually had a SEAL team. Once we had the facility set up, the Hughes mining barge wasn't there yet, but we knew where it was going to go. We actually had a SEAL team out of San Diego run a penetration test against our facility, and they didn't make it.
Oh, well, there you go.
Because they're used to shooting people as they go in. Well, we wouldn't let them do that.
Yeah, shoot us on the way. To put it together, the people putting it together, they couldn't know what it was, right?
Right. Well, no, the people who worked in the barge knew what it was. Who we wouldn't let know what it was were all the people who built the piece parts. This was a jigsaw puzzle. The manufacturing strategy, for an example, the propellers, we built those. Well, we didn't do it, but there was at that time a very substantial company in Sweden that built submarine propellers that wouldn't cavitate, and so ultimately, after a bunch of here to do's and intergovernment agreements, they built some propellers for us. We would then take those piece parts and we would ship them through cutouts. So they would ultimately arrive at the barge, but the guy who sent them would have never known where that was.
And the people in the middle presumably didn't know what was going on either.
Yeah, it was just point to point. And the last point was always a government installation, not necessarily military, but it was a government installation.
So it might have been a national laboratory or an observatory or who knows what.
All of the above. I mean, because the ship itself, for an example, when we designed the lower body hulls, right? The drawings that we would send to the whoever was building that particular section would be drawn upside down.
So they were building something that they thought was a cover, when in fact it was a hull.
Yeah. So, and when you think about building 300 tons of that kind of stuff, it was a major logistical issue. All of which we accomplished from start to finish, from design approval and go ahead, until we floated her out the first time. It was all done in 18 months.
Woo! Today you couldn't get the contract done in 18 months.
Probably not. But remember, we were operating as a black program, and so about 80% of the bureaucracy was sidestepped.
Which is why you got your nickname.
Yeah, boy, did we piss a lot of people off.
I'm just jealous.
So, Chris, I got to say, you talk about, you know, you're going to build your boats on the water, and obviously that's what they already did, right? They built the stealth ship on the water.
Right. You know, I just recently made Facebook friends with this young Coast Guard officer. He was trying to get his ship to go faster. His brand new cutter. Posted some video of speed trials just this morning. And these systems, ships, boats, you know, it's so romantic. We all, literally all of us, everybody on Earth has this image of ships in the sea. And it's basically just true. That big monstrosity, anything, you know, any good ship on the water is, it's an analog for life, right? The uncertainty, but control and everything else, which, you know, to bend it back to our topic is, that's business, that's cybersecurity, that's building systems and rockets and ships and the whole thing. You have to, you know, embrace the complexity. How complex do you want it to be? You can, time and money will make it as complicated as you like. It's all fun.
There's a bunch of stuff here that came out. One of them is the cutouts and the cover story. So this approach is a wonderful approach. It is a counterintelligence approach. It is rarely used, but when it is used, it can be very effective. So I just thought I would note that one. And then we have the SEAL team. Now, I bet you anything that the people in the SEAL team said, we would have won if they would allow us to shoot folks.
Oh, yeah. And they almost certainly were right. Yes.
Well, I don't know if they were right, you know, because those folks would be able to shoot back. But,
yeah,
you know, it's sort of, oh, you cheated. I couldn't kill anybody. Okay. And then you have the inspectors. Okay. So I've dealt with inspectors. One of the things with inspectors is, in my experience, you never want to say, don't look at that. Because that's their job, is to look at it. Right. And if you say, don't look at it, they say you're hiding something. But you know, indeed they were. You know, yes, we're hiding something, and no, you can't see it. So I just, the whole concept, you know, of doing that legitimately for high valued, high consequence situations, it's such a wonderful just experience to live through John when he does that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I have had opportunities to get, you know, clearances and classification before and turn it down. You know, and it's not religious about it and so forth. You know, it's just it's a cost benefit sort of thing, right? You know, you have to go through other restrictions and whatnot. But, you know, I live vicariously through, yeah, all my friends like John. It's like, seriously, you did? Okay, let me get this straight.
The other thing is he's allowed to talk about that, right?
Right.
But note that in our previous discussions with John, he said, well, one of the few things I can talk about out of this warehouse full of stuff. So, you know, Warehouse 13, the TV show, right?
Exactly.
Well, I can talk about this one. How many were there?
my impression of, you know, all these sorts of groups, but, you know, we're talking about the U.S. federal government, other governments as well, but U.S. federal government on the whole conspiracy theory plate, aliens and, you know, laser weapons or whatever. Yeah, my thoughts, you know, are that there's one or two maybe. But it's a whole warehouse of possibilities. You know, just looking forward is the same as looking back. Like, how many, you know, how many grand things could an organization like the U.S. federal government really have going on right now? Some. That's a lot of resources. But not wow. all of them. Thousands. Every possible thing, no. Thousands. Yeah. Yeah,
well, this is part of the counterintelligence effort that we don't necessarily do very well, which is making it less certain to an observer which, if any, of those we're doing.
Well, exactly. Because
remember, if they're trying to counter them, they have to address the uncertainty by addressing all of them or picking which ones and hoping they pick right.
Well, I like the way you first described to me your early work on deception, right? You know, where you set up the tests, you know, so that, you know, normal sort of red team, blue team thing. And, you know, except at one point you just turn on or, you know, the everything is yes. All the information, you know, everywhere you look, you find an answer. You know, the basis of deception, right? You know, I have no idea what's real. And had to end the test early because you're worried about, you know, actually damaging the effectiveness of the people involved because they just gave up. It's like, where do you start? And we forget how much we rely on all these cues that are around us all the time. And if you think about it, you know, and I, you know, then you can actually, you know, confuse those cues to the point that you can't make any sense out of it.
Well, you can do real harm to people. We didn't end the test early. They asked us to stop and we said, okay.
Okay.
You know, it's not, look, you know, you're there to do science, right? You're there to test things. So you need controls and all the other things to do tests that are effective tests. But, you know, you also have a moral and ethical responsibility with your subjects to not harm them or not knowingly harm them. I mean, one of the problems here is, you know, when you're harming somebody psychologically, it may not be apparent until afterwards.
Right.
And so, you know, you try to put controls in place, you try to do reasonable things. But, and the other thing is, what is the ultimate harm, right? So people take one path or another in their life. They come to a decision point and they took a different path because of our psychological experiments. But I don't think we were doing any great harm, but I do think that they decided that attacking computers was something they did not want to continue to do. And maybe that is an effective treatment. I think to the point where you have criminal attackers and so forth, you might reasonably treat them with these sorts of methodologies. But I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I don't get
Nor
to do...
Nor do I play on TV, yes.
Yeah, so I don't get to do treatments. But in the other part of the world, where we're in a conflict situation, then, you know, that is something that we can do. And if we harm the soldiers on the other side who are maliciously attacking our democracy...
It's a conflict. That, ready.
Well, you know, as much as I don't want to harm the people, I do want them to stop doing that.
Well, you know, Sun Tzu said it best, right? You know, the ultimate goal in conflict is to remove the will to resist, right? You know, so, yeah, and you know, professional soldiers, you know, people who work in conflict of all sorts, you know, military and physical or not, you know, usually understand that what you want is just to make it stop, you know, explain to the other side that moving forward is not going to be effective. And if that means blowing things up or making firm statements, it's effectively the same tools.
In fact, I very much favor the idea of doing this with information rather than with physical mechanisms, because frankly, if they're upset and unable to continue attacking my computer systems because they're psychologically impaired, even if it lasts for a long time, I think that's better than taking them into small pieces. So.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the cyber show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
So, Maria, it's great to see you. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Fred, and I want to thank you for inviting me on this very wonderful program that you've put together for the cyber community.
Have you had a chance to listen to any of our shows?
I have not. I must admit I have not, but I will.
So, well, the point being that it might not be anywhere near as good as what you just claimed. All right. So we know we can't believe anything you say, right?
I guess so.
I bring that up because, you know, I'm on the engineering side and you have done a lot of sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. And one of the engineers' complaints is that the sales and marketing folks make stuff up. Right. And they're all...
And one of the sales and marketing folks complained is about the engineer's disease, where the engineers keep screwing up the sale by introducing all sorts of problems that really don't exist. Is that an accurate representation?
Well, it is of the general sales and marketing team. But since I started out as an engineer, as a software engineer, so I was, back in the day, was known as a computer programmer before we got all these fancy titles. I sort of fell into marketing because I was one of the few software engineers that could actually write requirements and describe exactly what I was coding and actually put comments in my code so other people could understand and follow and use any, you know, functions and things like that that I wrote, that I made generic enough that could be reused, like reusable code. Remember that kind of stuff?
And, we had a discussion about reusable code with apparently people in educational institutions think that's cheating, but I'm not sure. So let's start at the beginning of your career. You're welcome to start at birth, but anything you want. But get before long to when you first encountered anything cyber.
Okay, I'll start when I first encountered everything cyber. I'll just briefly mention that I started right out of college working for a company, a defense contractor known as Lockheed Martin, Lockheed Space and Missiles Corporation, right?
Where John Tippett worked for a while, and okay. we call that Lockmart. But let's go back in time. Where did you go to college and what was your degree?
I went to California State University at Chico, and my degree was in information and communication studies, which was basically what was called computer science back in those days. And, you know, we had such a robust selection of programming courses like Pascal and COBOL and Fortran. Remember all those letters?
Did you use today at all?
Exactly.
Exactly. All right. So everything you learned in college is now obsolete. But that's not true, because you also learned structurally what goes on and about data structures and all these things. So you learned the math behind it and so forth. So it's not that it was a waste. No. It's just that there's a general misperception that the computer language is something special. But the language is just the syntax in which you express the semantics, right?
Exactly. So I got my first start at Lockheed Martin, writing in a language that nobody heard of then, and I don't think it's ever been used since, called Ada.
I was just going to say, are you talking about Ada?
Exactly. So I worked on it.
Ada had a lot of beneficial things, right? Uh-huh. And one of the things it had was abstraction, right? So,
exactly.
So you could interface to something else without knowing what was inside of it.
Exactly. And, of course, the reusable code sections, right?
Let's talk about reusability. The detailed specification of what it actually does inside and its, you know, time, space, performance characteristics and complexity and all this stuff, you can't really just reuse it. And so usually reusable means with modifications.
With modifications. You're correct. Right. You would your input parameters, right, were, you know, you could change that. You could take that and with minor changes, you know, go ahead and reuse that function for whatever purpose suited you. But we were encouraged to do that back then.
So did you like Ada or dislike Ada?
I liked it once I got the hang of it. Right? Because it was completely different from anything I had learned.
There's a discipline associated with it.
It is.
And one of the things that a lot of people complain about is the lack of discipline today. Mm-hmm. Although many of the languages and, you know, force you to do ridiculous things because of their foolish discipline. But we'll get to that another time. So Chris, an early entrant, you don't actually know the date yet, but an early entrant into women in the cyber world. You know, when it wasn't popular or friendly or most, you know, women weren't involved in that world, you know, she ends up graduating and going immediately to Lockheed Martin Space and Missile Systems and programming in the, you know, strange computer language of the day.
Well, right. And as you see with so many of these stories, you know, again, you and I and our peers and so forth is an interesting cadre of folks who followed interesting paths to be here. And looked at from all sorts of different perspectives, like women in cyber. the gender gap in professional fields in my lifetime, in my working career, has changed a lot. Thank God. You know, you look back at the beginning of this and there, you know, before I got into computers, I'm of an age to remember, you know, the first female, I don't know, you remember being a little kid and seeing this in the news, the first female CEO of, or mayor, or, you know, whatever.
Astronaut, right? The first female astronaut, right?
Right.
I mean, that's all sorts of things. Really recent. Yeah. So I went to engineering school, right? When I got my bachelor's in electrical engineering, our class of 150 electrical engineering students, when it started out, had two women in it. And the 75 who got to graduation still had two women. So, and I always felt as if I wanted more women in the engineering program because it, you know, it got awfully lonely, at least with my orientation. You know, my mother was also, you know, she had a PhD in physics.
Right.
And, you know, she, when she was alive, she spoke about, you know, sort of all the aspects of being the first woman at each thing she did.
Right.
And so it's, I'm really glad the world is changing, has changed, but in cyber, it really hasn't, right? In cybersecurity, there's an enormous anti-female bias in the way things work, which I find offensive, but it seems to be there.
Well, I think, you know, and the gender issue, we can go back to Marie Curie, right? You know, this has been evolving, as you say, your mother, it's not just in our lifetimes. It takes a long, long time. You know, this issue has been evolving slowly. It's gotten better. You know, you and I have managed to live through a period where you can see it get demonstrably better. But, you know, we're still not there yet. And
well, I mean, women's suffrage, right? Women's suffrage. So what happened, of course, was, you know, African-Americans out of slavery got to vote, but the women still couldn't vote. And, you know, you're always told to get in line. And I don't think it's good that you have to get in line. I think this view of people as, well, wait till I have mine and then you can have yours. I just think that's offensive.
Well, I think, as you know, I've done, you know, now just about 50 podcasts on transparency, right? Not about supply chain security or anything else. Like, let's just talk about the values and where we've been, where we are right now, and where we think might be going, on just being honest. Because what, you know, coming from an American perspective, we're capitalists. We believe that free speech and so forth is more competitive than not. Right. And
hang on, I'll say you and I do, but I will say that is contrary to these beliefs. So we have this expression that claims that, but the underlying reality is no, you know, we're not going to, you know, we still want, you know, as a society, I think it's 30% of folks in the US now are supporting of Nazi ideas. Right? That's not our free speech society. That's not the banning of books in Florida. That's something completely different. So I think that's not a good assumption.
Well, you know, I also agree that the arc of history bends towards justice, right? You know, and it's not an even curve and so forth. However, right, and this is, anyways, you know, getting back to our topic, right? You know, this is in the cyber infrastructure, you know, the implicit bias, right? You know, and Ron's talking about a bunch of guys that got together and said, let's keep women out and let's make, you know, computers not work for them. It's just a whole series of things stretching back decades, centuries, millennia, who knows? You know, that sets up a situation where you have a bias built into a system. And at some point, you know, if that matters, and I think in this case it certainly does, you have to go to the next level and start looking at, you know, what was it? Look, you know, I do this all the time, like literally multiple times pretty well. Every day, every meeting that I'm leading, I'm probably saying at some point, here's my biases. Here's what I think is true. I could be wrong. Someone please tell me if I'm wrong. We have to have that scientific curiosity about the systems we've already built and not get, you know, defensive and just say, great, new use case. Wow. You know, we've got a massive gender disparity and the technology lends itself in ways that are non-optimal. Good. Let's fix that.
Yeah. So those of us that try have a tendency to have problems achieving it. One of the problems, and by the way, it's the same, maybe even more so in the venture capital and investment world, where enormous, ridiculous discrimination against women. And you just have to look at the numbers to see this. And I find that offensive too, but there's not really anything you can do about it unless you're one of the people that has enough money to make a change. And I'm not one of those yet, but when I am.
Megan Samford, you know, is doing great work out there right now. And let me see, where is Megan at the moment? Chief Security, Product Security Officer at Schneider Electric. But, you know, before that job as well, Megan has done great work in leading the Women for Industrial Control Systems effort, which is making it a measurable difference, right? You know, and again, it's like so many of these things, what we need to do is encourage, you know, improvement, you know, whether it's financial business operations or security or issues like this, you know.
Yeah, this encouragement thing. No, I think we need to kick down the doors yelling and screaming and saying, get out of the way. Here's a woman who knows what she's doing.
When that works, I'm with you too.
If you don't help her, we're going to kick you out.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers.
96 now, decided to build the program, and it takes you 2 years to get approval. So, but in the meanwhile, you were building some other pretty astonishing forensic capabilities there, right?
Oh, right. Absolutely. We developed a forensic science program. And of course, Henry Lee and Bob Genslin were two of my colleagues there that we worked together so hard on creating the forensic science program. And so once the forensic science program was put together, then basically said, look, we can go into forensic computer work as well. So this was very important stuff that was happening. And one of the interesting things that occurred was as I moved into the dean and director of the University of New Haven, the California campus at this point in time gave us a chance to set up some computer science programs right in California.
So the California program you started, correct me if I'm wrong here, University of New Haven was in Connecticut, right?
Right. But
And the California program is on the other side of the country.
Yeah.
And yeah. So how is it that you came to decide that this small, you know, private university in Connecticut was going to have a campus in California? And then what did you commute?
A very easy decision. The University of New Haven was going broke. I was the only unit on campus that was making money, but I could see I was not going to be making enough money by staying in New Haven. So I basically talked with Larry DeNardis, the president, and said, Larry, I can set up a program in California and I can utilize, once we set up forensic science, I can get Bob Genslin, who is director of the crime lab in Sacramento, and we created a faculty of actual professionals that I appointed as adjunct faculty. So we had prosecutor from Sacramento County. We had crime lab personnel. And so basically, I did this simply because I was getting so many applications for the program at New Haven, but we couldn't accommodate all of them. So I said to Larry, look, the answer is I'll go to Sacramento and I'll start the program there because it's low cost because I'm using all adjuncts and these adjuncts are going to make this work. And so all of the applications that were just not being used because there was no more room in our New Haven campus, I could then take 30 students and send them out to California. Now, some of the students, when they applied to New Haven and they got a letter from me saying, and a call saying, look, we are filled in New Haven, but I'm starting a program in Sacramento, California. Would you consider coming? And, oh, they were just thrilled.
Well, that was better than going to Connecticut, right?
Right, right. So I had the program going quite well.
So hang on. Again, you keep rushing ahead.
So now you're using, were there other programs around the country where they had people that were working, you know, PhDs working in actual forensic laboratories that were also teaching graduate students to do that?
Yeah, there were some. There weren't that many programs in the forensic science area. At that point in time, we were one of the few. And because Henry Lee and Bob Genslin had such marvelous reputations, and we utilized such great people in that program, that the forensic science really went quite well. And so it was easy for us to start it then in California, based upon the fact that I was still living in California, but I was flying into New Haven, all the time. So,
so when you say all the time, just for clarity, you were commuting between California and Connecticut how many times a week?
Oh, no, not a week. I did a lot of flying. I mean, you know, look at my air flight. I've got 3 million miles of air.
3 million frequent flyer miles, 2.5 million of it between Connecticut and Sacramento, right?
Well, quite a bit was done overseas, but we'll get into that one later. But the other interesting point, this is why it's so fundamental to this whole area of computers, because while I was doing this in Sacramento, in forensic science in our Sacramento campus from 1997 to 2007, then 2008 decided we were going to become director. I was director of the University of New Haven Sandia Livermore campus.
Okay, so let's talk frequent traveler. At one point, he knew most of the flight attendants on most of the planes that went back and forth between Sacramento and Connecticut.
And Tom Wood, he's the kind of person who would actually do that as well, right? And I love the reason for it, because the college was going broke. You know, disaster is quite often a great opportunity. As we talked about previously with regard to Tom, you know, momentum and inertia and so forth, you know, when everything's going fine, you know, it's hard to get people to change. But when you can see the end of the runway from here, you know, suddenly this crazy idea of starting a campus, you know, look at the world today. You know, that's not unusual at all.
You know, for a university, a sort of a small liberal arts university with a little bit of science and engineering on the East Coast, to open up a campus in Sacramento because Tom lived in Sacramento. So, you know, there's something about that that says Tom must be a very rare bird in order for that to fly.
Well, right. You know, and again, this is the cyber show. You know, in our lives, you know, the rare birds are the sort of common ones, right? You know, because, you know, if you're going to be doing interesting things, you know, it's because you're looking at systems, whether they're, you know, academic systems, you know, legal systems and so forth, you know, technical systems. And saying, you know, if we bounce on this board right here 3 times, right on Wednesdays, you know, it'll, you know, here's how the mechanisms work. And we could probably do that differently. Standard operating procedure for being non-standard.
Fair enough. I just find these interactions. The thing is, Tom moves mountains like a teaspoon at a time.
Right.
He's always pleasant.
And you look at one day, it's like, didn't that used to be over? No, it's not there anymore. Yeah.
No, that's right. Oh, yeah, we have a new campus, you know, whatever. So one thing after another, he does the seemingly impossible slowly, pleasantly, nicely. He's pushing it all the time, but apparently he pushes just hard enough to get it done, not so hard that people fight back against him.
Well, yeah, I found that to be the big lesson, right? You know, being unusually smart and having an unusually interesting idea about how some technical system works isn't necessarily that unusual among a certain crowd. What's unusual is, like Tom does, surfing ahead of that and saying, all right, you know, why won't that work? Because if I walk in there and tell everyone they're wrong, they probably won't let me go forward. You know, so teaspoons are a great hacking device.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill warns you to check your inputs, John goes to law school, Tom takes more territory, and Maria sees her Trekkie dreams come true. Another pitch hits the wall, and much, much more, only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time's head bow. good time out at that ball. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time out at that ball.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.